Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for October 2, 2003. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And two interviews scheduled for tonight. First, we'll speak with, or listen to an interview recorded earlier this week with Ursula Hughes, author of a collection of essays called The Making of a Cybertariat, Virtual Work in a Real World, a very fine collection just published by Monthly Review Press of her stuff. Oh, from over the actually started, I think, the earliest essays from the late 1970s. So a look over the last 20, 25 years of the emergence of a cybertariat and the interactions between virtuality and reality. Also, Ursula Hughes will have some things to say about offshoring, the movement of a lot of service jobs offshore, specifically to places like India. And then at about 5:30 or maybe 5:40, we'll speak with Anna Malinow, who is a doctor in a poor community in Texas, and she will be telling us about the Census Bureau report released earlier this week on the number of Americans without health insurance. But we'll get the big picture numbers, but also some feel for what it's like. Some 60% of her patient population consists of people without health insurance, and we'll talk to her about what it's like as a doctor and what it's like for them as patients trying to stay healthy in a world where staying healthy can be very, very expensive. And before we get to the Ursula Hughes interview, a look at the some of the economic news, as I've been doing at the beginning of the show. And on the international scene, one of the big stories these days is what's happening with currency values. They've got several issues wrapped up here. One is the long-term problem. Many, many, many years, going back into the early 1980s, the U.S. running a very large trade deficit, importing more than it exports, and as a consequence, running up big foreign debts in order to fund those deficits. And these imbalances have persisted. Normally, recessions are times when those trade balances go a little bit closer towards zero, but that hasn't really happened this time. The U.S. Trade deficit is still gigantic and shows no signs of shrinking. And this can't go on forever. Countries like the United States, can't keep borrowing money indefinitely abroad to finance living beyond their means. And something has to give at some point, and the big question is when. Of course, we could have said similar things pretty much any time during the last 20 years, but nothing is given yet. We're pushing our luck, to say the least. And one of the ways in which that giving might manifest itself when it finally happens is a weakening in the value of the U.S. dollar as foreigners despair of American economic problems and pull their money out of here and the dollar sinks. Now, over the longer term, that could actually perversely help the United States by making our exports cheaper in world markets and making imports more expensive. But in the short to medium term, there would be very serious financial dislocations as the U.S. Quite possibly thrown into recession, the Federal Reserve forced to raise interest rates even though the economy was weak in order to try to keep capital from leaving the country, and it could get very unattractive. So the big question is, when will this process start, and if it hasn't already, and what might it look like? And also, another issue wrapped up, kind of closely related, is U.S. anger at some of the Asian economies, especially China, for allegedly keeping the value of their currencies too low, stimulating their exports at the expense of U.S. manufacturing. So the group of seven countries, the U.S. and its major rich country colleagues, issued a statement on September 20th at the World Bank IMF meetings in Dubai, in which they called for more flexibility in exchange rates. And this was taken to mean that the dollar should fall and that the value of some of those Asian currencies should rise. Although this was issued in the name of the G7, it seemed that the United States was really the most enthusiastic about this. Japanese and British officials quickly denied that there was any change in currency policy. And then even Snow himself, our Treasury Secretary, who is really quite a dim bulb, rather like his predecessor, Paul O'Neill, he said, well, there's been no change in our strong dollar policy, but no one believes him. The financial markets, at least, have been taking this to mean that the G7 countries want to see some decline in the value of the dollar. And as a consequence, the yen and the euro have been rising. So we shall see if this what effect this has. There's some anxiety that any kind of serious rise in the value of the Chinese currency could cause China some serious economic problems. Something like 45% of the loans in the Chinese banking system are non-performing, as they say, which is a way of saying that they're bad loans. And if the Chinese economy runs into trouble, then those non-performing loans will be performing even worse. So there is some risk in this. So a lot of drama over currencies and what that might all mean. And in a lot of ways, currencies are kind of a proxy for international economic relations. We have politics that are still organized according to national at the national level. We have economies that are often quite nationally oriented, but the currency is where national economies join the world economy, and currency problems are actually signs frequently that there's some problem with how a country fits into the whole thing. So that's what currency problems may seem rather abstract, but they can result in rather serious economic dislocations. The United States has been largely insulated from this problem because of the fact that the U.S. dollar is kind of an international currency, and we've been able to borrow in that currency and do business in that currency and not really feel too much of an effect from what happens to our currency's value. But that may change. So we shall see. One of the evolving stories. And the evolving story that we've also been following here every week is what's been happening with U.S. economic recovery. And it's not doing so good. It's kind of sputtering. Some numbers looking okay, some numbers looking not so okay. And let me just review a few of those. First of all, it was reported this morning, I believe, that yesterday, that automobile sales fell off a bit in August, but they're still running very, very strong. This has been a very strange recession. Usually in recessions, automobile and sales and car, well, truck sales as well, SUV sales, and housing also. These usually decline rather dramatically in a normal recession. These things have not happened this time around. And that's one of the ways that the cars have been continuing to move off the lots is that dealers have been, or manufacturers rather, have been offering very, very juicy financing terms, 0% interest rates, and they're effectively not making any money on the cars they sell. They're just breaking even, and according to the laws of capitalism, you can't do that forever. There seem to be a couple of impossible or semi-impossible things being sustained here. A very high level of demand for cars at the same time that nobody seems to be making any money making them. So it's a rather strange economic period we're living through. It was also reported this morning that companies... orders for capital goods, machinery, and which are very important to getting the economic recovery accelerating. They're not doing too well. The August orders for capital goods fell when they should be rising if we wanted to see a healthier economy. So it seems that a lot of the hangover from the bursting of the 1990s bubble still is still in effect. A lot of companies are very unwilling to invest and also to hire. And along those lines, it was reported this morning that the first-time claims for unemployment insurance, that is people who have just lost their jobs, who report to the unemployment insurance office for to sign up for benefits, that is a number issued every week, every Thursday morning, covering the previous week. So it's a very timely and economically and humanly important measure of what's going on in the labor market. Those claims rose by some 13,000, and we're back up at just below the 400,000 level, which is considered to be the dividing line between recession and recovery by a lot of analysts. Also, the number of people continuing to draw unemployment benefits rose for the week. So the job market is still the worst part of the U.S. economy right now, just no signs of recovery. And we've also learning that It's not so much a very high pace of layoffs that is keeping the job market so weak. It's just that companies are not hiring people new and not recalling people after having laid them off in the recession. So it's just no job creation going on in this economy. Tomorrow morning, we'll get the employment report for September. It's likely to be flat or slightly down. If it's a positive number, that'll be nice because it'll break a streak of 7 consecutive monthly losses. So, still, I don't see much of a sign of recovery in the U.S. job market. So it's not looking so good, and it's impossible to sustain any kind of economic recovery for very long if the job market doesn't recover, and if people's incomes don't recover. So this is the strangest economic recovery one has ever seen. The recession officially ended in November 2001. We've lost over a million jobs since then, and that's extremely unusual behavior. The recession of the early 90s ended in March 1991, and the economy continued to lose jobs, but only for another year. This time we've lost jobs for 2 years, and there's really no sign that that is about to reverse. So it's, I think, going to, among many things, mean more political troubles for George Bush, who certainly is developing a plate full of them right now, and it couldn't happen to a nicer guy. So that's some of the economic developments in the last week or so. And now, an interview I recorded earlier this week with Ursula Hughes, author of a collection of essays put together by Monthly Review Press called The Making of a Cybertariat, Virtual Work in a Real World. She's a very lively writer, lively mind, interesting collection of essays, and I think a rather interesting interview. So let's go to that. Ursula Hughes, interview recorded earlier this week. Let's start by going back, to some of your earlier stuff in this collection. But these are a perennial concern. There was a lot of concern over the years, going back as far as anyone can remember, that automation would lead to a severe jobs crisis. And this never really materialized. And do you have a theory of why that is?
Well, yes, I do. If you look back through history, you see that whenever there's been a huge wave of technological innovation, like, for instance, the introduction of electricity or the introduction of information technology, that there have been all these dire predictions of mass unemployment. But in fact, although there's often been localized unemployment in the places where the old industries were, there's almost always been a regeneration of employment somewhere else. And the conclusion I came to is that capitalism has an incredible ability to generate new commodities. And that raises the question of where do these new commodities come from? And it seems to me that the only place they can come from is from our areas of life that up to that point have been outside the money economy. And one main area of life which is outside the money economy is work which is done for nothing in the home. If we look back to take the electricity example, look back to the 1920s and 30s when electricity became widespread both for production and for consumption, the new businesses that arose during that period were making things like washing machines, vacuum cleaners, radios. In other words, they were an automation of tasks which had previously been housework. And it seems to me that because there are always going to be areas of life which are outside the money economy, there are always new areas where new commodities can come from. Healthcare is one example of that. The drugs industry can be seen as a huge commodification of personal care. And that seems to be an industry that has almost no limit in terms of how fast it can expand and how global it can become in terms of its markets.
And do you think this process is inexhaustible, where is this action happening now?
Well, I think it may be inexhaustible. It seems hard to imagine it, but we now have commodities that our grandparents just couldn't have imagined that such commodities could exist. The vaginal deodorant, for instance. or an insurance policy that you take out to against the possibility that you might have to make a claim on your other insurance policy. I think one of the points I should make is that it's not just physical goods that are commodities. Services can also be commodities. And one of the things that we've seen in the last 20 years with the wave of technological change that's accompanied information and communication technologies has been the generation of lots and lots of new service-based commodities.
Let's talk a bit about domestic labor, too. You've written on that. One of the paradoxes that many people have noted is that despite the invention of many labor-saving devices, or the introduction of capital equipment into the home, basically, burden of domestic labor hardly seems any lighter than it was a century ago. What do you attribute this to?
Well, I think that the nature of domestic labor has changed enormously. And I think one of the ways it's changed has been in the old days, if you like, in pre-capitalist economies, domestic labour is just producing use values. You're just producing something directly to feed your family or, to clean up after them or service them in some way. And as capitalism has become more and more complex and as more and more areas of life have become commodified, the household labour has been transformed into what you might call consumption work. But instead of being unalienated work where you're just providing a use value for somebody, you've become part of the capitalist process. The work of consumption is work that is alienated, which you don't control the process of it, and it's a substitution for work that previously was the paid work of service workers. For instance, if you use an ATM machine, your unpaid time and your unpaid labour is substituting for what used to be the paid time and the paid labour of a bank teller. When you wheel your trolley around the supermarket, you're substituting for what used to be the paid work and the paid time of the worker in the store.
But now a lot of people would perceive that as more convenient and time-saving.
Well, it is more convenient very often if the alternative is waiting in a long line. But one of the things that's happening is that the pressure on service workers to become more and more productive, the speed up of work in the service sector, including in telemediated services like call centre work, is effectively that squeeze on service workers and that tailorisation of the work of service workers is externalising more and more of the labour and the time. So we are spending more, as consumers, more and more of our time, like hanging on the phone, having pressed button 2 for customer services and then gone into another menu and pressed button 4 and being told your call is valuable to us, please hold, and listen to synthesized Scott Joplin for 10 minutes and you finally get through to, hi, my name's Tracy, how can I help you? And not only has your time been wasted, but the process of your interaction with Tracy has been tailorized because Tracy is working to a standard script. You can't say, hey, Tracy, you sent me the wrong product. She has to say, well, first, please can you confirm your zip code? And please can you confirm the registration number of the product that you bought? And please can you confirm, and so on. And she takes you through this script. So you, as a consumer, have lost your autonomy in terms of your relationship with that service worker. It's like the service worker and the service user have both been scripted by some kind of disembodied person or process that neither of you can get at.
But a lot of the ideologists of especially the recent era were telling us, that we'd had a new economy, a new era in which Taylor was obsolete. you know, all these old job descriptions, all this detailed planning, time and motion studies, all this was obsolete because now we had spontaneity and flat hierarchies and, you know, the end of all these sort of boss-employee relationships, and, you know, we're in a new era. You obviously don't agree with that.
Well, the research I've been doing across 45 countries around the world indicates that Taylorism is alive and kicking. Alive and kicking in the data entry factories in the West Indies and in China, alive and kicking in the call centres in India and in Malaysia, and alive and kicking, unfortunately, in the living rooms of all the consumers who have to interact with these people.
Let's talk a little bit more about the ideology of the new economy, a topic dear to my heart. You've written very critically and very well, I think, of people like Danny Kwa, who had theorized that we were in this post-material era. Things didn't matter. Alan Greenspan has said some truly silly things about the amount of poundage per dollar of GDP declining over time. There's a sense that things don't matter so much anymore, and what really matters are ideas. And Kwa, of course, Danny Kwa is famous for his theories of weightlessness, the weightless economy. Charles Leadbeater's, you know, thin air ideas. What do you find wrong with this line of thinking?
Well, the classic example that the weightless economy people trot out is that of the sports shoe. They say, take a sports shoe, only 4% of the value actually comes from the labour of making it and the raw materials. The other 96% comes from knowledge. It comes from the design, from the marketing, from the promotion, from all the other, if you like, service activities that go into making that product. Therefore, they say, this is a weightless product. But what they seem to forget is that if nobody buys the physical sports shoes, these bundles of leather and plastic and rubber, you don't have to put them on your feet. You can leave them in your closet if you like. But if you haven't bought it, nobody makes any profit out of selling that shoe. The value that is embedded in all that knowledge is never realised unless somebody actually goes out and buys the physical commodity. And the fact that only 4% of the value comes from labour and raw materials says to me something very, very shocking about the difference in pay between the women and children in Indonesia who make these shoes and, you know, the people in Madison Avenue who take the other 96% of the value in their promotion and marketing and so on. And this idea that things don't matter anymore and, you know, value is accruing to the economy only from selling services and only from selling things that are weightless completely flies in the face of the evidence. That if you look at the statistics, there is at this moment in the world more physical manufacture of goods than any other time in history. They're not all being manufactured in the United States, but the world consumption of copper has gone up, world consumption of aluminium, of paper, of wood, you name it. And if you're sceptical about these statistics, take a look at the amount of garbage which is produced in every city in the developed world, which is going up exponentially year on year, and that is certainly material garbage.
I think it's, 25,000 tons a day in New York City? I looked up that number recently. But where do you think this kind of thinking comes from? Is it an extreme version of commodity fetishism?
In the late 90s, I think some people genuinely were quite carried away with this kind of notion of the cyber economy and everything being virtual and everything being weightless. And they kind of forgot their own bodies. They forgot that, you know, there they are wearing real clothes and eating real food and sitting on real chairs and living in real houses and traveling in real automobiles. But I think it's hard for people to see the connection between the new economy and the old economy because it's now so spatially separated around the world. But the new economy, in fact, is not something autonomous. It is something which is deeply connected with all the so-called old industries in the old economy. People in call centres may be knowledge workers, but if they're selling things, they're selling something. If they're dealing with complaints, they're dealing with complaints about something. They have a relationship with the old industries. And the new economy can really be seen as, if you like, an elaboration of the division of labour, which has become more and more complex, the social division of labour. And the separation of head and hands, if you like, is not just separated in terms of white-collar workers and manual workers on the same physical site as it used to be 50 years ago, but they're also physically separated, and are very often also working for different companies, so they're legally separated as well. So that the kind of connections between the different parts of the economy have become invisible to people.
I'm speaking with Ursula Hughes, who is the author of The Making of a Cybertariat, Virtual Work in the Real World, just published by Monthly Review Press. In the 70s and 80s, we heard a lot about new technologies making it possible for people to work from home. And this is a trend that really didn't quite take off with the intensity that some people thought it would, at least not in the United States. What happened?
Well, there's a limit to what kinds of jobs can be carried out from home. Not all jobs involve processing digitized information. For instance, you know, you can't dig roads from home. You can't lay cables. You can't serve people food. You can't harvest crops. You know, you can't look after babies. Look after children in a school collectively. There are lots and lots of things that physically can't possibly be done from home. There are also limits in terms of managers' ability to trust people. A lot of research on working at home suggests that even though we now have surveillance methods that mean they can be very closely monitored, an awful lot of managers are incredibly reluctant not to have people they can physically see and physically order around under their noses in a workplace. In fact, in the United States, the taking the broadest definition of working from home, it seems to have stabilized at around 16% of the workforce, but that includes people who are working from home in a second job, or people who work home at weekends and things like that. In Europe, it's quite a bit less than that. In the UK, it's around 7%. It seems to me that it's never going to possibly exceed more than around 10% of the workforce. Of course, a lot of people are working from home are not using computers at all. They're in very, very traditional industries like, you know, making clothes and assembling electronics and making toys and crafts and things of that sort. And that's you know, been around for the last few years.
Yeah, I'd heard tales after the Asian crisis in Thailand, a lot of the formal factories closed, and male workers lost their jobs, and they were replaced by women who are working in their backyards in rural areas.
Yes, and even very, very organized industries, like, for instance, the Japanese car industry in the 1980s, which everybody thought was about as automated as you could get, they were actually outsourcing panel beating to farmers, you know, who were doing it in their home. It's always been there. I've interviewed home workers in the United Kingdom who are sewing seat covers for Ford Motors. But you have to go down through a chain of maybe five levels of a subcontractor, to find the connection between the home workers and the company. It's always been there at the fringes of manufacturing industry, and now with the new technology of service industries. But it still seems to me to be something which is useful for employers to have as a kind of like a reserve army, but will never replace kind of mainstream manufacturing and service industries.
And let's turn to something that's in the news quite a lot in the United States over the last few months, outsourcing, offshoring, whatever we call it, tremendous growth in, we heard in the 80s very much about the relocation of factory work to lower wage countries, but now we're seeing a very apparently large movement of a lot of service work to low-wage countries. So could you talk a bit about what's going on, what your estimates of the scope of that is, and where it's going to go?
Well, we did a survey in 18 countries across Europe, and then subsequently ran the same survey in Australia. And this was a couple of years ago. And at that point, we estimated that around 6% of all employers across the economy in Europe were already outsourcing at least one business function to another country. Not all of that was outside Europe, but quite a significant amount of it was. And we've since been doing a lot of case studies, mainly in Asia, but also in other parts of the world. And it seems absolutely clear that a new global division of labour in information services is growing up. But having said that, it doesn't cover the entire globe. It goes to certain kinds of countries. There are, in our estimation, 117 countries in the world, which are most of Africa, most of Central Asia, big chunks of Latin America, some parts of Southeast Asia, like Cambodia, for instance, which are completely left out of this development. And that what is happening is that polarization between regions of the globe is growing as particular regions, if you like, develop specialist niches in this new global division of labour.
So place still matters.
Place matters more than it ever did. In a kind of paradox, here we have a technology which theoretically means that a whole range of activity can be done by anyone anywhere, provided the infrastructure's there and provided you've got people with the right skills. But the reality is that because you've got the world to choose from, employers who have the world to choose from, like, we can put our data entry anywhere in the world, so they get picky. They start, say, looking, what are the advantages of Barbados as against the Philippines? And a very, very tiny difference might swing the balance. The same way that, you have a supermarket where you can buy coffee from all over the world. So you might get really picky about, shall we have Colombian Arabica beans or shall we have Kenyan beans? And a very, very slight difference, if a whole lot of people in the market are making the same decision, if it swings everybody towards the Colombian beans, that could spell disaster for the Kenyan coffee farmers. And you get a kind of winner-takes-all scenario. And we're seeing that, I think, a little bit in the so-called new economy, in certain parts of the world which have been very successfully finding a place in it, like Bangalore for software development, for instance, and other places which are really being left out.
But this is true even within the richer countries, that the place still is quite important.
Yes, it matters more and more, because each place is now in competition with each other place. Whereas before, if you had, say, a medium-sized manufacturing company in New York, let's say, the chances are you would have all your different functions all in the same spot. You'd have your marketing here, you'd have your data entry here, you'd have your design here, you'd have your distribution here, and your manufacturing, etc. Each function, you think, well, where should we get our software developed? We've got the whole world to choose from. Where should we get our data entry done? We've got the whole world to choose from, etc. So each function can be relocated somewhere differently according to the competition within that particular market, if you see what I mean. And that creates very, very intense competition. Of course, there is an inertia in the system. Not everybody moves, because you can move. But the fact that it's possible to move can be held over the rest of the workforce as a threat. You've got 10 call centres, you put one of them in New Delhi. The workers in the other 9 call centres can then be told, well, look, if you want better conditions or more wages, you're just going to get too expensive. We might send your jobs to New Delhi too.
Which brings us to, I guess, the politics of all this. Your term, the cyberteriat, alludes to the proletariat. And, of course, is it possible to organize this class into unions? Is it possible for this class to think of itself as a class? Or is this going to be a matter of perpetual dispersion, atomization, and relentless competition?
Well, it's very difficult to say, because what we have is what, traditional analysts would call a common class. We have workers on opposite sides of the globe who have the same labour process, thanks to Bill Gates. They're using the same same software, they're working for the same employers, they're interacting with the same customers. They have everything in common that you could imagine that ought to make them into a common class. But they occupy completely different positions in, if you like, the local hierarchy. For instance, in medical transcription, you have in the United States home workers doing this work, often perhaps not very highly educated, maybe junior college level education. And exactly the same work is being done for exactly the same companies in India at an eighth of the cost by women who are postgraduates, in many cases medical graduates, who can earn more doing data entry in India than they can being doctors. And they have, as I said, the same labour process, they're working with the same employers, but they don't see themselves as, they don't identify in any way with the people who do this work in the United States. They would see themselves as part of the local elite. They speak English, they're postgraduates, they are of a class background that, for instance, would have servants. And they, if they identify their interest, it's with, if you like, the rest of the Indian middle class. They wouldn't see themselves as like lower class workers.
Well, now the image of this you get here, though, is that of extreme exploitation. People paid pennies an hour, but you're suggesting it's not. It's a little more complicated than that.
Well, it's relative. It's relative. They're earning a lot less than equivalent workers in the United States, but they're earning a lot more than they would in the local economy. For instance, these medical transcriptionists are earning about three times what a high school teacher would earn. In the call centre industry, it's more complicated. There are people in Delhi now working in call centres. They're earning about twice or three times the average local wage for a graduate, but they're earning less than they would be earning in the software industry. And a lot of them are people who were working as programmers up to a couple of years ago. There's been a big recession in the Indian software industry because, you know, America sneezes and India catches a cold. So they're doing jobs which they think are of as beneath them, and they're very highly educated, and they know very well what their equivalent workers would be earning in the United States. They're extremely technologically literate. They go on the internet. They know how to do research. They deeply despise their customers in Europe and in the United States, who give them a lot of racist abuse on the phone and who they regard as pretty dumb.
I have the same reaction to Americans a lot of the time, too. This is a very complicated issue here, because a lot of the discourse around offshoring here is very hostile to the foreign worker. Mm. At the same time, you know, people are losing their jobs here, and there's a real serious employment problem in the United States. We're not recovering from, a lot of the numbers are looking better, but the job market is not recovering, and offshoring is identified as one of the reasons for that. So what... And people in India or Malaysia are getting jobs and at incomes higher than they might have otherwise. So what's the proper attitude and maybe organizational strategy, a rhetorical strategy about this?
Well, it seems to me that we have, since 1989 really, we have a situation for the first time, there is a possibility for workers of the world to unite, as the Communist Manifesto put it. You have global markets, global corporations. You know, McDonald's is in every country in the world, IBM is in every country in the world, lots of other companies are in every country in the world. We have effectively a global language. We have communications that can spread throughout the world very cheaply via the internet. So there ought, in theory, to be the possibility, for the first time since those words were uttered in 1848, for workers of the world really to unite. But in fact, we have a situation where national differences and racist differences and cultural differences are so strong that it's extraordinarily difficult to see how workers can actually get together and organise. And at the moment, the kind of what some people might regard as a demonization of Islam, which is going on, and other things of that sort, are creating such enormous political and ideological rifts within the global community of workers that it seems extraordinarily difficult to see on what basis people can unite.
And that was the voice of Ursula Hughes, and I should spell it out. It's the Welsh spelling of Hughes, H-U-W-S. And she's the author of The Making of a Cybertariat, Virtual Work in the Real World, a collection of essays just published by Monthly Review Press. And she's also a professor of international labor studies at the Working Lives Research Institute, London Metropolitan University, and director of research, the research consultancy Analytica. A very original thinker and a good talker, too. And some of the essays in this volume, which range from the late 1970s to the last couple of years, New Technology and Domestic Labor, Terminal Isolation, the Atomization of Work and Leisure in the Wired Society, The Global Office, The Information Technology and the Relocation of White-Collar Work, Women's Health at Work, The Fading of the Collective Dreams, Reflections on 20 Years of Research in Women and Technology, Material World, The Myth of the Weightless Economy, and The Making of a Cybertariat, Virtual Work in a Real World. Ursula Hughes, The Making of a Cybertariat, published by Monthly Review. And we'll be back in a moment after this word from the members. A bit of the members' song from 1979, Offshore Banking Business, and there's a line in there, they don't hire no local staff, which is really no longer true, is it? But that was about a different kind of offshore business, tax shelters in the Caribbean. Some connection to what Ursula Hughes was talking about. And was it on September 30? Was that Tuesday? Monday? Tuesday, the Census Bureau reported that the number of Americans without health insurance rose last year. excuse me, rose by 1.5 million. The number of uninsured to 43.6 million people without health insurance in the United States. 43.6 million, and that's the count of people without health insurance for the entire year. That is 15.2% of the population, up from 14.6% of the population in 2001. And that's a rather high number. And we're now joined on the line by Anna Malino, who is a doctor in Texas, who is affiliated with the Physicians for a National Health Program, and she has a practice, I think 60% of which consists of patients without health insurance. So let's get her to talk about the big picture, but also what it's like to be a doctor with that kind of patient population. Welcome to WBAI, Anna Malino.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So we heard the headline numbers, over 15% of the U.S. population without health insurance for the entire year. What does that look like compared to recent history?
Well, the number of uninsured has gone up for sure. That was an increase of 2.4 million to 43 million. However, I think that the larger picture is really what is not said by these statistics. In fact, it's not really 43 million people that have no insurance, but it's more like 74 million people under the age of 65, which is really almost one out of three that are without health insurance for parts of the year. Earlier this year, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation released a report that was prepared by Families USA for the Cover the Uninsured Week, which happened in March of this year. And basically what they did is they wanted to see how many people were uninsured during all or part of 2001-2002. So what they were doing is they were looking at gaps in healthcare coverage. And what they found was really amazing, and that is that nearly one in three non-elderly Americans went without healthcare coverage during parts of the year. And most of those people actually went without health insurance for over 6 months. So you can imagine that having a gap in health insurance is really just as bad as not having health insurance. So the numbers that we were getting from the U.S. Bureau of Statistics, Census Bureau, are really much worse than what we're getting.
What do we know about what kinds of people go without health insurance? What do the demographics look like?
Well, we know that the Latinos are particularly hard hit. One in three Latinos are uninsured. That African Americans, that's about 20% of African Americans are uninsured. And those again are the statistics that we're getting from the U.S. Census Bureau. But if you look at the overall picture again, the statistics among the minorities are even worse if you look at healthcare gaps.
Well, people who are below the poverty line are eligible for Medicaid and get health insurance of some kind, right?
Not necessarily. First of all, it really depends on where you live. If you're from certain northeastern states, then it's a lot easier to get coverage. However, if you're in a place like Texas and many, many other states, particularly that have been hard hit by the economy and are pulling back on their resources, it's much, much more difficult. The Children's Health Insurance Program, for example, here has really sustained a lot of hits, particularly in the mental health area, and Medicaid for children and pregnant women has also been hard hit as well. So no, just to say that because you live in poverty that then you can get health care is really not a fair statement at all to make. There are many, many barriers that are put up for people that have no income or low income, actually.
And what about older people who are eligible for Medicare? How adequate is that coverage?
Well, that's great. If you can make it to 65, you're really in business. That seems to be the point around here, is to make it that long so that then you can get health care coverage. Now, Medicare is not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but it's the best that we have as far as a national health insurance program that we have in the United States.
It seems that even people with jobs these days are finding they're losing health coverage or having to pay more of it, or people with health insurance are finding that the insurance itself is not really adequate to the task. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that that's the other major point that we need to get across, and that it is not a problem of the uninsured. It is not a problem of the poor. It really is a problem of all of us. I think that if you go to any gathering and you ask people there to raise their hand if they have ever gone without health insurance, it doesn't really matter who you are with, you will get people there raising their hands. And that's what I'm finding across the board, is that this is really a problem that involves all of us. It isn't just, you know, of them and us anymore. It's everybody. It's those that are employed, those that are unemployed. And the uninsured, as you know, 80% of the uninsured are employed. And so it really cuts across all lines. And what we're finding is because healthcare costs are escalating to such a degree that employers can no longer afford the premiums. And so what they're doing is they're cutting back in many ways. They're either increasing cost sharing to the employees so that the employees have to pay a greater share, or they're cutting back on the benefits, or they're not giving them raises. And as we know, pay really is just health benefits really is just another way of wages.
If I'm remembering correctly, I think health insurance premiums have doubled in the last 4 or 5 years.
Yes, they have. They went up again 13% last year. And when you compare it to overall inflation, which is maybe like 1.2 or 1 to 2%, or an increase in wages, which was really just like 3%, it's really a phenomenal increase. And then when you look at states like Texas, you know, we like to be number one in everything. well, includes all the bad things as well, our average increase in premiums last year was 25%. It jumped up that high.
My God. Now, when Clinton was first in office and made his national health proposals, that was, what, 1994, that was perceived as a political crisis then, and then it just sort of disappeared from the scene as a political issue. What's the problem? Why is this not causing the kind of controversy that it should?
Well, you know, I have to take issue with that. I think that we are going to start seeing a movement towards universal health care. And I think what happened in 94 is that there were a lot of things that were going in favor of managed care or mangled care or however it is that you want to call it. We were in an era of economic boom, and people had jobs, which meant that they could get benefits. Again, they would be getting benefits and not such high salaries. But I think that everybody thought, well, we're going to give managed care a try. We've been seeing a decade of increased health care costs, and so what we're going to do is we're just going to see a new system to see if the market forces can help us out. And what we saw is that there was a somewhat of a decrease in the rate of rise of health care costs. But that has a lot to do with what insurance companies did as far as their cycles, and again, that they were helped by good economy. And what we're seeing right now is, in fact, that the HMOs and managed care really failed us, and we're back to where we were before, except worse.
As I remember at the time, a lot of people said that this shift to managed care might provide a brief interruption of the relentless rise in costs, but it would resume again, and by God, that turned out to be an accurate prediction.
Right. No, absolutely.
Let's tell us a bit about your practice. You have a rather poor patient population, 60% uninsured. Where is your practice, and tell us what it's like to deal with folks who are have a hard time paying the bills?
Okay, well, I come from the state, not originally, but I now practice in the state known as the Leave No Child Behind state, and where we do all the time, unfortunately. I work in Houston in the county hospital here, the largest county hospital in Harris County, which is in Houston, Texas. And we see approximately 20,000 children a year. I work in the Pediatric Emergency Center. I'm a pediatrician. And as you've pointed out, 60% of the children that I see have no health insurance. Now, I think that the numbers are staggering, but let's start with the United States. In the U.S., our Secretary of Human Services was very proud to announce, in fact, that we are holding fast with the number of uninsured children at about 11% or so. And if you look at the state, about 25% of our children are uninsured, which is just phenomenal. We are number one in the country as far as people who lack health insurance. 25% of the people here in Texas, and 25%, almost 25%, 25% of the children in Texas don't have health insurance. And in the particular clinic that I serve, 60% of the children have no funding. So it is a tremendous, tremendous problem. But again, if you look at the entire year, people who have had no health insurance for the entire year. But if you look at Texas and you ask people here in Texas if they have had a gap in health care coverage in the past 2 years, 40% will say that, in fact, that they have had a gap, adults and children. So it's really, really high. It's a tremendous problem here.
You must see that this takes some kind of the lack of insurance must take tolls on the health of the kids. They're just not getting routine kinds of attention.
Oh, absolutely.
What does it look like?
Well, it's bad for everybody. It's bad for everybody. It's bad for the patients, for the parents, and for the providers that are really trying to take care of them. I have found that in the past 5 years or so, I've become less and less of a physician. I feel like I don't really even use my stethoscope, my otoscope anymore, because basically what I'm trying to do is to help my children that I see navigate an incredibly difficult and complicated healthcare system. Basically, they come in and, yes, I can make a brilliant diagnosis and then write the best prescription for them, but if I know that, in fact, I write the prescription and there's no way that they can afford that medication because they don't have insurance, then what good was my diagnosis? Really, what good am I doing? nothing in the end. And so what I do is I just sit down and I try to help the parents see if the child qualifies for the county health insurance, do they qualify for Medicaid, for CHIP, and that's really where we spend much of our time. You can imagine having a chronic disease, it's terrible. We can give our patients maybe 1 month's worth of medication to try to keep them out of trouble, but 1 month later, you know, they're back in the emergency room with an attack of asthma, or, you know, if they happen to have diabetes, or any of the chronic illnesses. But then also for the preventative health care, it's bad, which of course feeds into the whole loop of becoming chronic illness later on.
We're just about out of time, but can you give us a little ad for Physicians for a National Health Program, which you're affiliated with?
Yes, we are an organization of physicians, and I think the last count was about 8,000 members, and we are nationwide, and we stand for a National Health Program. You can actually log on to www.pnhp.org and find out all sorts of things about us. But basically, we are trying to play a critical role in bringing the whole cause of universal health care to the fore and to Washington, but also at the state level. PNHP really is a national organization of physicians interested in universal health care. However, there are many, many statewide organizations that go by different names of Healthcare for All for the most part. I happen to be the chairman of Healthcare for All Texas, and we are a statewide organization, again, that is trying to open up the discussion about universal health care.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, and thanks for doing your part to open up that discussion. I've been speaking with Anna Malina, who is a doctor at a county hospital in Houston and sees a very poor population of people without health insurance. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and we'll be back next week with yet another panoply of delights. And let's go out with this from Slater Kinney, Call the Doctor. Sort of titles related, even if the lyrics aren't necessarily so. Goodbye.